Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. Now I have a mixed bag of things. We're going to talk about hormones and mental health. We've got a few short things. We've got some emails to bring us to a number of topics, but I have to start out with this one because, and I do apologize, this is maybe going to creep you out a little bit, at least if you're of the feminine persuasion. But recent research has been looking at per- and polyfluoral alkyl substances, that's PFAS, the so-called forever chemicals. And a researcher in China was looking at this, and it was he was published a few months ago, and then the American researchers tested products after they read that. And there are considerable amounts of forever chemicals in some feminine hygiene products. And these are compounds that contain fluorine, and they provide nice, appealing physical properties. They have oil and water repellency and stain resistance. So it's not surprising that they might end up in non-stick cookware. Teflon, anyone? The miracle substance that keeps your eggs from sticking to the pan. Textiles, of course, and Scotchgard, by the way, is a PFA. People use that to waterproof their clothing, and a lot of cosmetics have PFA in it. Even dental floss has, certain brands have that. So it's everywhere, and it never goes away. So the problem is you flush it, it just goes somewhere else and enters the water cycle and comes around again. Now, feminine hygiene products that they looked at, of course, there's a broad category. They did not, I want to emphasize, test tampons, but actually they did test tampons. I saw it here. Sanitary pads, panty liners, paper diapers, menstrual cups, bactericidal liquids, and this was the study done in China, and the products that were found to contain the highest sum of PFAS concentrations were paper diapers, sanitary pads, and menstrual cups. But that study only looked at ionic PFAS, and those are the ones that have a charge on them. But there are also neutral ones, and the neutral ones are going to be able to soak into skin more easily. So in this study, they did a very In looking at the previous studies, they did a very thorough look at a number of products. I'm just going to read you a little bit of it, of some of the previous studies that have been done, in just to validate the concept of skin absorption. There was one study done by Abraham where they basically put PFOA in sunscreen, and they put it on a single person once, and then they tested their blood for 48 hours, and about 1% of the dose absorbed into what was found at the blood. So that's that's a substantial amount of absorption. And the neutral ones seem to absorb better. They can also be inhaled, which can happen, I guess, if you burn your Teflon pan. So they looked at the United States sourcing and Central America sourcing of 59 reusable feminine hygiene products, and they basically cut them up into little squares, 1 inch by 1.5 centimeters, mounted them on target frames, and hit them with an ion beam at the St. Andre facility at the Notre Dame Nuclear Science Laboratory. So, I mean, ping, ping, ping. And they measured the products and how much fluorine was in them, and they separated into three categories, which is just environmental presence. So that would be nothing intentional. That was about 71% of the samples didn't have added. Intentional, at lower levels, lower than 1,000 parts per million, and that was about 10%. And then intentional, where the fluorine compounds had been added to the product for sure at more than 1,000 parts per limit, And the reason they used, they had this 110 to 1,000 was that 1,000 has been set by a number of entities as the middle value for a functional concentration of PFAS in school uniforms, where it's set by legislation in several United States and also by an international company. And these non-polymeric PFAS are designed to allow you to spill your lunch or your ketchup on your chest and wipe it off and not have a terrible stain that your mother throws her hands up or your father throws their hands up, whoever's the laundry person in the house. The highest concentrations, however, and this is scary, were in the period underwear samples. And these are special underwears that have a shield, basically, in the crotch to keep you from leaking. And they are all, they have a lot of this fluorine in them. Concentrations up to 77,000 parts per million. And that definitely could be absorbed, particularly if you're having heavy periods and wearing those things 24/7. This particular product has been shown to have up to 60% dermal absorption in some skin models. Now, I want to emphasize there hasn't been a lot of testing beyond that sunscreen studies, and 71% of the products were clear. We got ourselves into this by being worried about polluting the environment with single-use products. And talk about unintended consequences of good intentions. Here we are now looking at a situation where, I don't know, I would basically buy myself a lot of cheap panties and just plan on tossing them because this does not look like you'll be able to figure out. You know, if you buy it on Amazon or wherever you buy online, it's unlikely you'll be able to figure out what you're getting and what's in it. So, quick little tip for older people who are suffering from nocturnal leg cramps. Recent study published, pretty decent study, was done in the community. People 65 and older who had at least two episodes of nocturnal leg cramps in the previous 2 weeks. They got a placebo or vitamin K. They got 180 micrograms of minoquinone 7, MK7. That's the one that Dr. Don recommends at roughly the dose. I say 150 for your bones. And if you're taking calcium and vitamin D and trying to not lose your bone mass, be sure you take that MK7 because that keeps the calcium out of your arteries. And the number of cramps was cut in half. Meanwhile, in the placebo group, theirs doubled. So the difference continued to widen over time. Over 2 months, the people who took the vitamin K had 21 fewer episodes of cramp, and those that they did have were less severe. You can eat lots of leafy green vegetables and get your vitamin K. Fermented soy meal products like tempeh and hard cheeses also contain high levels of it. The only people who have to worry about vitamin K supplements are people who are taking warfarin, which is a blood thinner that's rarely used in our country anymore because the new factor 10A inhibitors like Eliquis are so much easier to deal with, both for the patient and the doctor. So our next story is about evolution in your intestines. So there's a lot of stuff in ketchup, salad dressing, toothpaste. These food thickeners like guar gum are believed to have to be very, very long cellulose strings, actually more like webs, and be non-digestible. You may have heard of resistant starch. That's kind of the Miller Lite version of the of this. It takes longer to break down, so most of the time it's leaving your body before you've had a chance to break it down. But researchers at the University of British Columbia have found that our gut bacteria can break down guar gum and these food thickeners. These are that they don't go through the system if they're broken down by certain bacteria. And this is, again, unintended consequences. So that we're talking ketchup here. We're talking salad dressing. And so a lot of people don't consider those to have any downward side effects, except maybe the bit of sugar in the dressings. But they may actually have more calories than they say on the label, because the bacteria in our gut develop enzymes, and they develop enzymes if we eat lots of fruits, vegetables, and cereal grains. That's what that does, is it causes the bacteria themselves to develop more enzymes in an effort to exploit all the fiber that we're throwing at them, for good reasons. But in the process, that activates the natural enzymes in the bacteria, and now they can break down even the artificial cellulose molecules. So an example of, again, unintended consequences, it just means that you need to be moderate in your use of these prepared foods with added thickeners. Let's go to our first email. Let me pull that out. This from Kelly in Santa Cruz. Kelly in Santa Cruz sent an email. Ask Dr. Dawn, Botox. Hi there, Dr. Dawn. There's a study on Botox, and then she lists the study, in Advanced Science 2024. Does this study confirm that there are negative effects on the brain from the use of Botox? I'm not clear on the findings. Please let us know your thoughts. Well, thank you, Kelly, for bringing this issue to my attention. It's interesting on several points. So let's just kind of back up a little bit. Botox is a toxin made by by Clostridia botulinum. This is a bacteria, an anaerobic bacteria, that is closely related. Its first cousin is the tetanus bacteria. And all of the bacteria in this family have the ability to produce toxins. Not all of them do. In fact, there are some friendly Clostridia that we keep in our guts to keep these other guys from growing there. You know, sort of like, yes, we want the good tenants, so we'll fill the apartment, and then we don't have to let the bad tenants in. But Botox was originally developed for clinical use to treat one thing, strabismus, which is a lazy eye, or a condition where the eyes don't line up and the person has double vision. This malalignment used to be treated by surgery, but it was found that you could inject a little bit of Botox into the muscle that acts like the reins on a horse's bit and line the eyes up correctly. There's also other conditions, blepharospasm. It's being used in large amounts in people who have hyperhidrosis, a medical condition where you sweat through your clothes 3 or 4 times a day. It's like your underarms are salivating constantly. And very disabling, very mentally disturbing for people. And so you inject the underarms with Botox, and it stops the release of acetylcholine from the nerve cell membranes. And that actually stops the process of sweating. So that's cool. It's used for migraines. Why it works for migraines is anybody's guess. But injecting the back of the head and the temples does seem to somehow break the cycle for many people. Now, in these sorts of application, it's important, Kelly, to understand they're using very, very high doses, and, you know, 200, maybe 300 milligrams. And it takes, there's one case that I heard about the other day of someone who got like 1,000 milligrams of Botox through a dosing error and actually got mild botulism from it. So, but we generally think about the disease itself, where you have this stuff being produced in your intestine, as producing major quantities of this toxin. And there is cited in this paper the fact that people with botulism have abnormal spontaneous brain activity, and they are using that as part of their support. The problem with this study in general is that Botox is used primarily in cosmetic applications at much, much lower doses. It's unusual for a person to get 80 units, let alone 800 units. So the idea that these very, very small doses would actually cause a substantial problem in the brain is a little remote. The hypothesis that they're trying to support with this work, which I'll tell you about the experiment in a moment, is that this could affect the microglia and cause more inflammation in the brain and potentially block the breakdown of beta amyloid and the tau protein, and therefore can maybe have that effect. It's a long stretch, let's put it that way. And they kind of set up what's called an organoid. So they took neonatal pluripotent organoids that comes out, those come out of the umbilical cord. And they built from these cells little brains, little tiny brains. They're called organoids. And then they put them in a two-chamber filter called a microfluidic device. And then they let the cells differentiate into into neurons and astrocytes. And then they put some Botox in the chamber. And then they took microglia, which are the immune cells, and they put those in the other chamber. And they waited to see whether, when you put toxin in there, the injury was effectively enough to trigger the tropic factors, that, in other words, the calling all cars signal to the immune system that would pull immune cells into the brain. It's a really lame kind of model, if I say so myself, that doesn't come anywhere close to mimicking what's really going on in the body. So they're building this to prove a point that it might be a problem. And that's what their article says. Botulism neurotoxin induces neurotoxic microglia mediated by exogenous inflammatory responses. And there's a lot of studies where they do this. They have cell culture and they add something and they say, oh, this is toxic because it kills the cells. And the fact is things like salt, sugar, cinnamon, thymol, which is found in the spice thyme, you know, we eat those things all the time and they don't kill our cells. They may make us diabetic, but they don't kill our cells. But if we put enough of them in a petri dish with our cells, it will kill them. So you can't generalize from something like this. So would I stop getting my Botox in my frown lines because I am worried about brain toxicity? No. I won't. I'm very happy with my smooth forehead and plan to continue to get dosed to maintain it, at least for the next decade. Let's go to another email that we got, this one from Nyanko in Santa Cruz, and he wanted me to talk about this Decode website and their myalgic encephalomyelitis chronic fatigue syndrome study. This was what's called a genome-wide study, so a GWAS. Briefly, a GWAS study is where you take people who have a disease and you do their complete genome, and then you cross-reference and find whether or not they have, well, places in common with variants that are non-typical. And in doing these GWAS studies, they found 8 loci that seemed to be significantly located. They had 15,000 cases of, and these are who got the genome studies, and they had a control group of 250,000 cases that were just not without this, who were without this condition, that comes from one of the information banks that we have on the genome. And they looked for, you know, whether having two X's or an X and a Y made a difference. They didn't really find that. They did find that this association often hung out with something else called CA10 that it has a known association to multi-set chronic pain. So let's talk about gene cassettes and gene clustering. Genes involved in similar functions will tend to hang out and have a common start signal. So you can imagine a bunch of genes in a row on the DNA with some little variants in between, some repeats here and there. But mostly you can pick out the genes, and they all are more or less related to a function. And then on another chromosome, you may have another cluster of genes that are also related to the same function. It's nothing is all on one chromosome. So you could postulate that perhaps the gene clusters that they identified, this cluster of eight loci, might be somehow part of the syndrome. Let's talk about the syndrome. Myalgia encephalitis chronic fatigue syndrome is the hallmark of this is post-exertional malaise. That means exceptional fatigue about 12 to 48 hours after a triggering activity, like you go mountain biking and you can't get it out of bed for a week, that kind of thing. Its other symptoms are pain, and the fatigue is not relieved by sleep, which is very atypical for those of us who are avid exercisers. You'll know you can get very sore and very tired, but usually the tired goes away with a good night's sleep. Now, this has become much better funded as a research source because of long COVID, because about 45% of people with long COVID meet the diagnostic criteria for this. And other phrases you might have heard about, chronic Epstein-Barr, yuppie flu, chronic fatigue syndrome, fibromyalgia, they're all sort of looped around each other in a big tangle. How important is this research? Well, Yanko, it's very important, but it doesn't give us much to work with in terms of we're just describing the problem at a higher level of detail. It doesn't really help us with understanding what's going on. And it doesn't help us identify it doesn't give us really a diagnostic test, because this is like having a certain color of hair or a certain color of eyes. It doesn't necessarily mean that you will be a good singer, even though lots of people with this color of eyes or this color of hair are good singers, and maybe a preponderance of good singers have that feature, but artificial or otherwise. But what does it really mean, and does it tell us anything medically? So I'm categorizing this study as interesting but not useful, at least not at the moment. Another few years, when we really get the AIs rolling, maybe we can feed these genes into them and what we know about what these genes actually do. And maybe some hypotheses that are testable will come out of that. But for the moment, I'm afraid it doesn't really take us from A to B. Let's go to some good news about diet and dementia. The study coming out of Massachusetts General Brigham, which I'm guessing is probably somewhere near Brigham Young University. Anyway, this study was also partnered with Harvard and they call them the Broad Institute. I'm sorry, it's spelled Broad Institute. And they published this in Nature Medicine. They found the big news is that the Mediterranean diet is really good for preventing dementia. People who ate this way, the MIND diet, they're calling it, emphasizes servings of leafy vegetables, whole grains, fish or poultry, olive oil, and lots of berries and nuts. And it places limits on red meat, butter, cheese, sweets, and fried food. So all across the board, people who adhered closely to this had a 13% reduced risk of developing dementia over the 10-year period. And those who improved their adherence in terms of getting better at that actually had a 25% lower risk. Those whose adherence declined, well, their risk increased. But the really interesting thing from this study was that they identified people who had the APOE4 gene, the dreaded APOE4. If you have, and I hear all sorts of different versions of the odds ratio here. So I suspect it's a bit like the odds ratio for the BRCA1 and the BRCA2. It depends on exactly what variant you've got and a lot of other things. But statistically, people with two copies of APOE4 have a 12-fold increased risk of Alzheimer's than those without it. And they looked at blood metabolites and cognitive health in a smaller subgroup. They analyzed data from 4,000 women in the Nurses' Health Study, and they start in 1989 and go to 2023, and they're doing blood tests, and they're also doing cognitive tests. They did the same with 1,500 men from the health professionals follow-up study. And that's another 30 years from 1993 to 2023. And they looked at their long-term dietary panels using food frequency questionnaires and looked at their blood samples for a broad range of metabolites. And then, among other things, they followed a subgroup with over 1,000 women with regular telephone-based cognitive tests. And what they found was that the protective effect of the Mediterranean-style diet was the greatest for the highest-risk group. And so if you have had your genes done and you do have the double APOE4, don't despair. Go out and buy some spinach and get a book on the Mediterranean diet and start getting your protein from fish, poultry, and eating lots and lots of vegetables, and staying away from highly processed food and giving your brain a break. It appears to work, and that is certainly good news. This is also an extremely healthy cardiovascular diet. So really, what are you waiting for? Time for a trip down the rabbit hole of hormone therapy. And so I'm going to start out with a little editorial. As the parents of teenagers will tell you, hormones can influence the mind as well as the body. Most recently, we have gone through a real sea change on the subject of thinking about hormone replacement therapy for both men and women. But a lot of times it's about symptoms, it's about hot flashes, it's about diabetes, loss of muscle mass, and those are all important. But the mental health piece of this is something that has completely escaped the psychiatrists. And I have many anecdotes, which I won't share with you, of people coming in who really just need to have their hormones straightened out. Worries about increase in breast cancer risk have dogged the woman's health for, well, 20, 25 years now, since the Women's Health Initiative study came out. But only about 5% or more of menopausal women take hormones. There is a kind of naturalistic fallacy here that what's natural, like menopause and aging, isn't a disease, and therefore we don't need to treat it. But we really do need to think about what we are throwing down and messing with, because we are able to do better with appropriate therapy. Now, among men, the problem is the opposite. Among men, there's too much enthusiasm, and we've got people who want a cosmetic effect. It's testosterone's a performance-enhancing drug. I mean, we've known that since some Olympics in, I think it was in Berlin in the 70s, when The East German swimmers, women swimmers came out looking rather too muscular to be real. In America, there's this huge industry to sell hormones to middle-aged men. And it's now with Instagram and the influencers, it's talking like it's the fountain of youth. And they aren't talking about, some of the downwards effects, like, for example, infertility and high doses, supernormal doses of testosterone, which are what the bodybuilders use, are bad for your health. Furthermore, if you're buying this stuff on the gray market, it may be contaminated. It may have other stuff in it. And the risk of death from breast cancer, let's talk about death, because that's mostly what we're worried about, isn't it? So the risk of death from breast cancers in women who use even the old style high dose hormone therapies is exactly equal to the risk of death from women who go through menopause and who don't take hormones. And the reason is that, among other things, most reputable physicians who are doing hormone replacement therapy are checking mammograms and will find cancers early. So although estrogen acts as a growth hormone for existing cancers, it's only a small subgroup of the population that has problems with their detoxification who's likely to have an increased risk of breast cancer. Problem is, of course, breast cancer is common for everybody. We still have a 12% risk. 1 out of 8 women who lives to be 85 will live to be 85 with breast cancer, and only a small percentage of those die of it. And when I've had the opportunity to do detoxification genomics on women with breast cancer, it's non-controlled, it's just observational, but I don't think I've ever found a woman who didn't have detoxification abnormalities in the way her body broke down estrogen and progesterone. So you have to wonder, is it the estrogen or is it the detoxification problem that's causing the issue? And as I said, we're leaving a lot on the table here, because mental health, poor mental health, depression, anxiety, these are affecting millions of people. And it's just not being looked for. The sex hormones, estrogen, progesterone, and testosterone, and by the way, both men and women make these, are potent governors of behavior, mood, and stress. Proteins sensitive to estrogen are found in many important regions of the brains, and this hormone can influence memory formation, recall, decision-making, problem-solving. Meanwhile, progesterone and testosterone have a calming effect via interactions with the GABA receptor complex. And many of you probably take GABA or something over the counter to try to increase GABA. That is the one of the relaxing hormones. Cortisol and the thyroid also play a major role in mood and behavior. Hormones and neurotransmitters are really the same thing. The difference between them is simply that hormones are released by glands into the bloodstream, and neurotransmitters are released by nerves into the synaptic space. But as far as how they work and what they are, there's a considerable overlap. So let's look at the statistics for men, because all women who are menopausal, who are not on hormones, are by definition estrogen deficient. In the case of men, about 35% of men over the age of 45 are testosterone deficient, and they may produce almost no testosterone, but the glands typically die a slow death. And so it's just written off as psychological midlife crisis, poor marriage, rage against the aging, et cetera, et cetera. Men with low testosterone far more often report symptoms of depression and irritability, and also cognitive impairment. Now, testosterone replacement probably should, or at least testing for testosterone, probably should be part of the standard toolkit when a man comes into the office with depression or identifies as having depression. The other two things that you want to look at are thyroid and the cortisol levels, because sometimes people are just go, 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 particularly if they're very athletic, and they can kind of burn themselves out. And you'll see that in the loss of the cortisol circadian rhythm. You can find that out with a simple saliva test. Easily done. So if you, there's a recent study, it was a meta-analysis, it came out in 2019, but it looked at just treating depression with testosterone. And they found that it worked in a surprising percentage of the 2,000 men who were tested. And the problem is aggressive promotion, making it seem like a cosmetic thing. And another group that's being missed is the premenopausal women. We know that premenopause starts about 10 years before your periods stop. And during that time, the ovaries fluctuate. They essentially gun the engine and produce too much estrogen and then sputter and don't produce any. So this hormone that is a brain neurotransmitter is going from, you know, 8,000 revolutions to, you know, sputtering along at 1,500. And do you think that's going to have effect, a cognitive effect on the patient? Well, of course it is. So researchers from Cardiff University published an analysis in England last year looking at the UK Biobank, which is a research body similar to the Framingham study. And they looked at 130,000 women who'd gone through menopause, and they'd gotten that far in their lives with no history of psychiatric disorder. During perimenopause, the risk of major depression and bipolar disorder in this previously, I want to add, previously stable mentally group went up between 30% for depression and 112% for bipolar disorder as a diagnosis. Only about 1% of women develop florid psychiatric conditions during perimenopause, but many develop more subtle symptoms like low mood, anxiety, mood swings, irritability, aching joints, memory problems, brain fogs. And this is way before you get the night sweats and the other symptoms that are classic menopause. A good flag for women who are in those perimenopause 40 plus years is waking up with anxiety for no reasons or feeling overwhelmed by previously manageable tasks. That's kind of a flag for a potential hormone condition. And another thing is the rapid cycling, where a woman can be fine some days and feel suicidally depressed on other days. That's hormone levels, folks. That's not mental illness. That's fluctuating neurotransmitter levels in the brain. The problem is mental health workers and even primary care doctors simply have no awareness, or not much. There are some, so I don't want to make a blanket statement here. That's not fair. But to the extent that women's mental health is affected by hormone fluctuations, it's important that we dedicate research to that. Now, we've just eliminated, in case you missed the memo, all research in medicine that has the word women in it. Those grants have been cut as, you know, somehow subversive or woke. And I'm thinking that the people who did that are asleep. Not, and they're the ones who need to get woke. This is just nuts. And just at a time when finally we're starting to climb out of the closet and do research on women, this happens. testing sex hormones in women is harder because the levels fluctuate literally by 10 to 30 times from the low to the high. So you have to do something else. You can do serial saliva testing. That's cumbersome, costs $200 or $300. You can look at basal body temperature, which is a very blunt instrument but can give you some clues. If it's not, you know, it's supposed to, you know, go up when you have when you release your eggs, you're supposed to see a spike. So that's in menstruating women, and what that's caused by is LH spiking. Well, in women who have perimenopause, when their temperature, when their levels of estrogen drop because their ovaries go on strike, they will get a shift in their LH, and they'll get an LH surge when the estrogen spikes, and so that's a hint because that affects the basal body temperature. So if you're getting weird erratic fluctuations in that, you have to know that you're getting weird erratic fluctuations in your hormones. Both men and women need to prompt their doctors, if they are experiencing depression or bipolarity, to check their hormone levels. And in the case of women, like I said, you're going to need multiple checks, but get that LH and that FSH when you are feeling bad, and then get it again when you are feeling great, and see what those levels are doing. Track that with your cycle. If it's all out of whack, then something's up. And that's the best advice I can give you, because hormone testing in the bloodstream in women is really, as I said, a very blunt instrument. Men have a stable release, but ladies, not so much. Oh, another thing about testing for the men, you want to get your morning level, and don't try to compare a morning level to an afternoon level, because there's a natural diurnal rhythm. This is easy, it's relatively inexpensive, and it will get to the heart of the problem in perhaps as many as half of middle-aged men who present with depression and irritability, and as many as a quarter of women in the same age group who are experiencing similar symptoms. So in my last 5 minutes, I want to talk about a organization that is one of the more exploitive organizations I've seen in a long time. I'm going to out them. They're named Game Day, and it has a chain of men's health clinics, and they have, essentially, you go into the waiting room, and it's kind of this man cave, black leather armchairs, TVs, a fridge. The nurse comes in and does a blood test. They'll find a way to, and if your testosterone is lower than the somewhat exaggerated normal levels for age that they use, you can have your first dose of injectable testosterone. Now let's talk about injectable testosterone just for a second. That's going to give you a high, and it completely is different from what your normal testosterone is doing. I think it's very risky, because you're getting a spike and then a gradual hill. What you're supposed to get is a whole bunch of little mini spikes every day. So this artificially increases the hormone level, but it does it in a way that is completely unlike what the normal healthy testicle would be doing. The number of men with lower testosterone now, is lower. We've got more diabetes, more obesity, more environmental toxicity, so more opiate use. So the testosterone is down in the population relative to what it used to be, relative to what the normals in the textbooks say. This hypogonadism is a real thing. I'm not trying to belittle it. But an organization that basically sets you up with a membership and gives you a more expensive injection than you could get with just using a regular daily cream in the morning, which is going to much more likely mimic the normal circadian rhythm. The good news about this super physiological levels is that studies have shown, a good study, that taking testosterone and with normal levels, normal physiological levels, does not increase the risk of prostate cancer, and it does not increase the risk of heart attacks, but it can increase the risk of infertility. So getting the two people before the testosterone gets too low is important, but also not giving them too much is important. And for those men out there who have low testosterone and low fertility, I have a little bit of a useful news flash. The problem with testosterone is it suppresses fertility by suppressing spermatogenesis. And that's because it acts kind of like a birth control pill would on women. It goes to the pituitary gland and it suppresses the release of the hormone, follicle stimulating hormone, that encourages the ovaries to make eggs, or mature eggs, I should say, and the spermatic ducts to make sperm. So if you discourage that, you're going to get a loss of fertility. Now, there's a drug called clomiphene citrate, which was originally developed as a potential contraceptive, but ironically, it turned out to aid fertility in women because it stimulated the ovarian cells to make more eggs. It did that by increasing the sensitivity of those cells to the pituitary hormones LH and FSH. So guess what? It works in men. It works for male infertility, and it can be given, it affects the testosterone to estrogen ratio. So it could be something that men would use to try to improve their testosterone and improve their sperm count. So it has a very, very interesting set of properties. It's sort of a hormone mimic, and it has been shown to improve erectile dysfunction as well. Younger men, actually, in particular, seem to do better with clonopin citrate relative, and of course, they're the ones who are more likely trying to conceive. It also improved bone density in hypogonadal individuals over the 3-year treatment period. So this is one of those new uses for an old drug, and if you're struggling with infertility and you have low testosterone, and that's part of the challenge that you and your family face, this might be something to look up and bring to the attention of your doctor. Doctor, is clomiphene citrate right for me? No one has ever come in and asked me that. I'm waiting for the day when someone comes in and quotes the commercial. I have been asked about drugs that clearly are being heavily promoted, but I'm waiting for that right for me question. Let's see if I have one quickie to run us out on. Here we are. Here's a good one. Can x-rays cause arthritis? Can MRIs cause surgery? I had a patient in the office today. A year ago, she had no pain in her knees. Then she had a slip and fall injury, and her x-ray showed severe arthritis. She was told she was going to need a knee replacement. She changed her behavior because arthritis is caused by wear and tear, and she didn't want to wear out her joint. She stopped running and went to a very boring bicycle, which I'm sure she's not doing as joyfully and as much as she did her running. And her pain has persisted. The nutrition that's getting to her knee is probably less than it was before she fell. Exercise is really important, especially weight-bearing exercise. You just don't want to pound. So changing, rather than stopping running, moving to a fast walk, walking uphill, even continuing to run, but running, don't go for speed. Just go for distance and pay attention to the signals your body's giving you. Take glucosamine sulfate. But if you're diagnosed with arthritis, don't stop moving. It actually probably causes more harm than good. And as far as MRIs causing back pain, I'll tell you, MRIs are a sales pitch for back surgery because everybody's back looks ugly after 50. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Spansky. Music by John Scoville.